And welcome to another edition of Hank Unplugged, the podcast that brings some of the most informative, inspirational, interesting, innovative people on the planet directly to you. And this is no exception. My conversation today is with Bill Dembski. And you have an opportunity to take the podcast that I have with people like Bill to the world by simply going to iTunes and giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes. That will get this podcast to the ears of so many people that otherwise would not hear the podcast. And we've been very fortunate with our podcast. We've gotten all the way to number 6 in the religion space on some of the podcasts. And I expect this to be one of the highest rated podcasts we've ever done because, again, Bill Dembski is a legend on a lot of counts. He's a mathematician. He is a philosopher, a theologian. He's a prolific author, and he is a leading light in the intelligent design movement, although he's gone on to other things that I want to talk to him about today as well. He has a PhD in mathematics, a PhD in philosophy, a master's of divinity from Princeton, and he is the author of a stack of books that I simply do not have the time to go over on the show. I actually thought at one time I would, but I was just thinking about going through all the books, and that would take more than 2 or 3 hours, so I'm not even going to do that. But some of those books are books like his Intelligent Design Trilogy, that's The Design Inference, No Free Lunch, and Being as Communion, which is a metaphysics of information, as well as a book that I loved. We promoted on the Bible Answer Man broadcast for a long, long period of time and continue to make it available to people. The End of Christianity, Finding a Good God in an Evil World. In addition to all of that, Bill has an honorary doctorate from Southern Evangelical Seminary. I guess that's about the only thing that I have in common with him. I have one as well. And we are both born July 18th. Of course, he's much, much younger than I am, 10 years, a whole decade younger than I am. And we both have tire tracks on our faces from fundamentalist buses. We wear those tire tracks as a badge of honor. Bill, I am just delighted to be with you today and have this opportunity to have a great conversation.
Hank, it's so good to be with you. It's been too long.
You know, I was wondering, you know, with that introduction, who are more vicious, Christian fundamentalists or atheistic materialists?
Oh, I would say the atheistic materialists, in my experience, although, I mean, it's been said that you can't beat theological wrangling, but that was my experience. But I think this challenge of intelligent design to Darwinian materialism, that just cut very deep, and so there was a ganging up that I experienced there. I mean, people trying to get me to lose my job, taking me to court and what have you, or trying to at least. But I guess with the fundamentalism, things were a bit more subtle. And I think one thing that helped me is that I did have a certain prominence. I'd already been, as it were, thrown under the bus by the liberals when I was at another institution, a more liberal Christian institution. I won't name it, but anyway. So by the time I was teaching at what we would might call fundamentalist institutions, I think people were wary that if they went after me, they might be dealing with a public relations problem. So I think people tended to treat me more gingerly than they might otherwise have. But I think the problem with fundamentalism is that there's a dogmatism that just takes hold, and it's majoring on minors. But these minors become then litmus tests for orthodoxy. And if you don't toe the line, you can be out on your ear. So I think the end result for me was really this book that you mentioned, End of Christianity, that there was something I had written that didn't set well with the seminary where I was teaching, and I was called in front of the president, provost, dean, and senior professor. And when you get that sort of notice, either you've been nominated for the Nobel Prize or you're in a heap of trouble. So I was in trouble, and it was telegraphed to me that my job was on the line. And so I ended up finessing my situation there, and it didn't feel good. And I had a sick son, a mortgage, and a wife who was already unhappy about all the controversies on the liberal and materialistic side. So, but I think at that point, something just flipped in me, and I said, I just got to get out of this academic world. And so I made my move, and in the last 6 years, I've been a businessman. So I've just switched over to educational websites and software and really left. I did get one book done where I was doing a lot of writing, that's Being as Communion. But other than that, that was in 2013-14, I've really left publishing and working in intelligent design. So I might come back to it at some point, but it's what can you say? I think I guess I just felt beaten up enough that and from both sides that I just needed to clear my head, and so I think I've done that. But I still don't have any real urge to get back to the fray, as it were. You know, I had one website that actually did quite well. It was enough to retire on, so I sold that in November, and I don't know. I sometimes joke that I'm semi-retired. I think there's just too much energy in me still to do things. But the sort of day-to-day controversy with especially the fundamentalists on the one hand and the materialists on the other, it's something I still think I'm clearing my mind from that.
In some way, you caught a glimpse of what your life was going to be like through the life of your dad. You were able to see the dark side of academic politics. And I'm just wondering how that affected you early on.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up my dad. I mean, he was teaching in a very racially charged Chicago school system. I mean, this was community colleges, city colleges of Chicago. And this was at the time Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there were lots of racial tensions. So, I mean, I did see some of the politics, but it wasn't the sort of politics of controversy where, you know, your neck is on the chopping block. I mean, it was more just the kind of general unpleasantness that can sometimes infect the academy. So, I think I saw that, but my dad always had higher aspirations for me. It was like, you know, get a job at a good university. And that's what I was looking at when I got my PhD in mathematics. I mean, I had tenure track offers, University of Indiana, Bloomington. I mean, it was a top 20, top 25 math program. I ended up going to MIT on an NSF postdoctoral fellowship. But what happened then is I had this urge, and I think it was by the Holy Spirit in the end, but just because you are urged by the Holy Spirit doesn't mean that everything is going to be hunky-dory when you give in, you know, to it. And so I ended up getting that second PhD, writing the design inference really as my doctoral dissertation, which then became really a seminal piece for the intelligent design movement, because it laid out in broad strokes just the type of statistical methods that would be required to make drawing design inferences legitimate as a scientific inquiry. And so it was trying to put intelligent design not just, it looks designed, to, hey, here are the features, the markers that will allow us to conclude reliably in a scientifically rigorous fashion that something is indeed designed. So I left mathematics, and I think I could have had a reasonable career there. I don't think I would have, I don't think I had the talent to be at a place like Princeton or Harvard, I mean, the very top schools, but I think I could have managed at a good research university. But I left that to get involved in this very controversial area. And the problem with intelligent design, I guess, you know, when I look back at my life, I mean, there's so many times when I was just naive. And so I I thought, well, you know, the Darwinian materialists, they're dead set against us. But, you know, I looked at so much of the Christian world, I thought, well, if they once they realize that design can be rigorously inferred, that there's a method, that there are these features in biological systems that map reliably onto things that are designed, then surely the Christian world will want to go along for the ride. And that's not what happened. I mean, you had, on the one hand, the theistic evolutionists who were like, wait a second, we already made our accommodation with Darwinism. Why do we want to go back to that? We've got all this credibility now. I think there's a great inferiority complex in a lot of the Christian education. So there was just, we gotta go with the mainstream on this. So there was a great reaction against intelligent design by a lot of the what I would call the CCCU Christian world, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. The fundamentalists, as we're calling them, I think they were happy with intelligent design for a while because they saw it as a stalking horse for dealing with materialists. They saw, okay, we've got something with scientific credibility. We can use that to advance our creationist position. But the thing is, intelligent design, who's the designer? Well, yes, as a Christian, I believe the designer is the Christian God, but intelligent design is not religion specific. I mean, I've spoken on these topics at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, for instance, and they were very happy with intelligent design. There, just about any religious faith that sees a purpose or teleology behind the world and is open to this having some sort of scientific expression would be open to intelligent design. So I think after a while, I mean, I remember in 2004, Dwayne Gish from the Institute for Creation Research saying, we love intelligent design. I would say 5-10 years later, that was no longer the case. It was seen as just not going far enough, not giving the full truth of creation. And from my vantage, it was, well, it is giving the truth, and just because it doesn't give everything you want, it's still giving us something. But I think there was also just this sense that, hey, we want a package deal. We want our creationist position to bring you squarely into the fold of Christianity, not just the fold of Christianity, but the fundamentalist form of Christianity that we advocate. It's not good enough that you come to intelligent design and you leave materialism and become a Hindu. Now, I don't know, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? For me, if there is real design in biological systems and intelligent design helps us to see that and do good science with it, that's a plus, regardless of where you end up theologically in the end. But I think for, I guess if I had to say it, I think the fundamentalists wanted to use intelligent design. They weren't interested in the ultimate truth of it so much as can we use it to advance our agenda. And, I don't think it ended up advancing their agenda enough. So I think a lot of fundamentalists are not with the program anymore.
You sort of waded into an area that got you into a lot of trouble. I mean, The End of Christianity, great book, by the way. I thought it was fantastic. But you waded into some things like the flood. And, is the flood global with respect to the earth, or is it universal with respect to humanity? Well, you thought that perhaps there was a possibility that it could be universal with respect to humanity and not global with respect to the earth. And Kim Ham, Genesis, what is it?
Answers in Genesis.
Yeah, Answers in Genesis. He skewered you. I mean, you ended up being a heretic. Of course, I was on the same bus. I was also denounced as a heretic by Ken. But it's amazing to see that you're simply suggesting, I mean, in passing almost, that this idea...
Yeah, if I just left that off, I think, it wasn't just Ken Ham. I mean, this was constantly the case. I mean, Ken Ham would go around speaking at churches and places and then denounce me and then denounce the school which had hired me, the seminary, Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth. And then I would get these letters from the president there responding. Oh, I mean, what the problem was, I mean, Ken Ham would denounce me, and then alums from the seminary would write to the school and to the president, and then he would defend me, and it just got uncomfortable. But with that, raising this question about the flood, that's what almost got me fired from the seminary. So it's, you know, that's where I had that meeting that I described earlier. It just, and I don't know. I mean, the thing is, you know, I had to go through a pretty rigorous statement of faith process and coming on board at that seminary. And I did not lie or misrepresent or anything. I was straightforward about my beliefs that I'm an old earth creationist. And the flood, the details of it simply did not come up. In fact, I mean, when I was asked to subscribe to the Baptist Faith and Message 2000, and, you know, that's, I could subscribe to that to this day, you know, but it wasn't enough. And I think that's the concern I have with so much of fundamentalism, that there is almost like, you know, thou canst not be conservative enough. You can't be quite orthodox enough. You got to, you know, if you're this far to the right, you know, push it a bit further. And it's a strange sort of thing, because I didn't see that 20-30 years ago, you know, with the conservative resurgence, because I think at that point the conservative fundamentalists were not strong enough, certainly in the Baptist church, to push this hard ideological line. And you had people like Al Mohler who were open to an older earth back then, but it seems like just consistently across the board there's been this ossification, this sense of, you know, we've got to be as conservative, as traditional as possible. And nothing wrong with conservatism and tradition, as long as it's open to the truth and trying to understand the world as it is and the scriptures as they are, and not force them into some sort of mold. But what I found also with fundamentalism is that it just seemed to revel in a simplicity. It's just trying to make things as simple for people as possible, give them little sound bites, and then you can run with it and you can be secure in your faith. Well, that works if you stay in your Christian ghetto. But it's not going to work if you're exposed to Bart Ehrman or the educational mainstream. And I really got into it with some of my former bosses and others, because they've been going after my friend and colleague Mike Lacona as though he were the Satan incarnate, because even though he accepts the literal resurrection of Christ, he raised some questions about the saints resurrecting in Matthew 27, and seeing that along the lines of something more like
apocalyptic
story, in line with also some of the writings of Plutarch. I mean, I'm not persuaded of it, but the thing is, they're going after him in a way that just makes no sense to me. You know, it's Christians shooting Christians. Then you've got something like Bart Ehrman, who at the end of the day is counting how many people in his intro New Testament course he's caused to lose their faith. You know, and it's so there's, but it, of course, it's always easier to go after the people that are next to you than the people who are. Farther away. I mean, it's the same thing, it seems, in wars. I mean, my mother's of German ancestry, my dad's of Polish ancestry. I have relatives in both places. And, you know, Poland and Germany have traditionally been at war. But you skip one country, you go from Poland to France, and Poland and France, they've been fine. You know, Chopin, one of my favorite composers, worked in he's Polish, but worked in Paris, you know. So it's like, you know, often the people that are closest to you, you attack most viciously, and I think that is something that I've seen, you know. And it's again nothing new in theological debate, but when you see it up close and personal, it's no longer theory. It's you appreciate it in a new way.
Yeah, and get pretty ugly. You know, you raise a couple of issues here that I want to address. One is, we talk about the young earth creationists who are taking the age of the universe as an acid test for orthodoxy. So if you don't believe in a 5 or 6,000 year old universe, you're a heretic. On the other hand, you have people in the young earth creationist camp like Paul Nelson, who has a tone and a demeanor, a style about him, which is very winsome. And so I can have him on the Bible Answer Man sure. broadcast and feel very, very comfortable knowing that he believes that I'm a Christian brother. I certainly believe he's a Christian brother. We can talk about some of our differences, but we do it in a collegial fashion. You don't find this with a lot of the fundamentalists either on the right or on the left. Bart Ehrman is a classic example of a fundamentalist on the left. You simply don't find an opportunity for collegial debate. It's sort of a gotcha game.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. In fact, Paul and I, we were office mates, Paul Nelson and I, office mates years ago, and I remember him describing there's the brittle young earth creationist, whereas the non-brittle one. And I would say Paul obviously was a non-brittle one, but there's this sense of, you have to toe the line, you have to be exact and exacting about what you believe, not just what the person who is the fundamentalist, but what the people that he or she is dealing with, they have to toe the line there. And I think that's it, as opposed to there being mutual respect and being able to listen to each other. I think it's just that they make this a litmus test, the young earth position. And then it's if you don't match up, then you're out. And they might say, well, it doesn't mean that you're not a Christian, but they're not going to associate with you. They're not going to give you any right to teach in their environment. I mean, they're going to be strict limits. So you're really going to be an outsider. I mean, if they don't exclude you from the kingdom, it's still you feel like you are. So I think you're absolutely right with Paul Nelson. I mean, he's a winsome guy, and I think it's all. I think fundamentalism is much more an attitude rather than a set of beliefs that you subscribe to. Can you respect other people? Can you listen to them? Is there still more for you to learn? Might you be wrong about some things? I think there's that sort of openness is, I think, something which we need. And I think it can be called teachability, but it's required if you're going to become, not just become an educated person, but have a life in which education never stops. And I think that's the problem, or a problem with fundamentalism. There's a sense in which at some point you've learned everything that's important, and there's nothing vital more to learn. So you can, in a sense, shut your mind down. I was at one school once where I raised some questions, difficult questions, and this one professor, I think he was joking, but in a sense he wasn't. He says, we think about these things by not thinking about them. And I was like, well, how about thinking about them, grappling with them, and even if at the end of the day there's irresolution, being able to live with that. But I think there's a sense of everything needs to be in its neat, tidy place, and I think life is messy, and the Bible can be messy. Dare I say it? But it's not. I mean, I used to teach this, that Bible is not a systematic theology. If God had wanted to give us a systematic theology, he could have done it. But it's a set of stories. There is theology. There are things that are perfectly clear, but there are lots of things that are paradoxical, and I think it's in the paradox often that we are pushed and forced to engage with divine truths. And I'm not trying to be wishy-washy here. I mean, Ten Commandments, Apostles' Creed, you give me a statement of faith, a reasonable one that's been held by the church through the years, and I'll subscribe to it. I mean, I can sign my name to it, but it's But it's when you go beyond that, it seems to me that and that you want things simpler than they really are, that you run into problems.
And that's the other thing that I wanted to raise with you. It seems to me that the problem, Bill, is that people don't know how to read the Bible in the sense in which it's intended. In other words, they're not very good at reading literature. They can read it literalistically, but they can't read it as literature in the sense in which it's intended. So if you have apocalyptic language, you read it as apocalyptic language. If you have a metaphor, you read the metaphor as a metaphor. If you have a simile, or if you have figurative language of any kind, if you have fantasy imagery like you have in the book of Revelation. But the other side of this coin is people don't know how to do science well, or they don't want to do science well. And as Christians, it seems to me that you set the standard for wanting to do both. Reading the Bible well, doing scripture well, doing science well.
Thank you. I mean, I take that as a compliment, and I think that is true, but I think it is also meant just realizing how ignorant I am, both about the workings of the world, nature, and about the scripture. I mean, it's not that I, for lack of trying, but it's just there's an awful lot to understand, and I don't think often we do understand it that well. And I think a problem is when we try to fake it and pretend that we do understand things when we don't. I mean, take Darwinian evolution. I mean, the idea that natural selection acting on random variations can produce the great diversity of life that we see from monad to man. I mean, it's ridiculous on its face. The power of natural selection to do this on random variations, where these random variations are given no direction, yeah, there's no evidence for the creative power or potential of this process. It's we see that life, that there's been a progression of life, that different forms have emerged, but we don't have an evolutionary, a strict evolutionary count, and we have no evidence for this mechanism being that powerful as a creative force. So it's so. But then, what actually did happen? You know, I think we've got good evidence for design, but filling in the details there, I think we're just starting to scratch the surface. If anything, you know, since I got into this debate 25 years ago or more, the complexities of life have increased. There's more to understand, more to figure out. And I'm not sure if the same can be said with scripture, but there is a lot to figure out. And bringing coherence to the scriptures, reading them in a way that is true to them, that sees the divine hand, the human hands in there, I think it's a challenge. I mean, I remember just, I get what you're saying with, you know, reading it as literature, but there are tensions, I would say, in Scripture, things we need to recognize that they're just not going to be readily resolvable. I mean, you take, for instance, the injunction against fornication and adultery in the Old Testament. You know, I mean, if your daughter, you know, had sex with somebody, she deserved to be stoned. Okay, it was very, this is Torah. I mean, it's very clear. Then you get to the New Testament, Joseph thinks that Mary has been unfaithful. What does it say? Well, she should be executed. No, it says that he was a just man and wanted to put her away quietly. I mean, the sort of harshness that is there in the Torah, and I think there's a reason it's there, because I think God had to impress on us the gravity of these sins, and yet in the New Testament there's a different face to it. You know, so I'm not saying. That's why I use the word paradox, because I don't think it's a contradiction, but there's a tension there, and it's not something that has an easy, you know, Bible difficulties explained. You know, here we go. Here's a neat one paragraph answer, and now you never need to think about this again. I think there are tensions there. Now, you know, here I am talking to the Bible Answer Man, and maybe you think I'm full of it, you know, after.
You know, I was actually thinking about that. I was thinking, you know, you're really full of it. No, actually, you know, what I was thinking about, I mean, I think it's absolutely true that we ought to live in the land of antinomy. There are a lot of tensions in Scripture that are not so easily resolved. I think some of the issues you bring up can be resolved, but what I'm really driving at here, Bill, is that we have to let the Bible do what the Bible is intended to do and science do what science is intended to do, meaning that you have these people that are trying to read scientific paradigms into biblical passages and having, you know, doo-doo all over their face. I mean, that's a very dicey proposition. So they don't really use the Bible in its intended sense. And the same thing is true with science. I mean, if you want to find out how old the universe is, the Bible doesn't give you a clue. It's not intended to tell you how old the universe is. You look at the book of nature and you get the answer there.
You're talking to the converted there, you know, no question. But, you know, it's interesting when you look at the history of biblical interpretation. Until up through the Reformation, people read the Bible, and this is, I mean, you go to church fathers and on, as teaching a very young universe. And I think the issue there is that science wasn't developed to the place where you could really answer these questions about the age of the universe. But once science was in a position to start answering those questions, then it seemed you had to start bringing these two into conversation. I'm not a fan of, I mean, there are different approaches to science and theology, and one is a compartmentalization or even complementarity approach, where basically you put, they end up being separate spheres of inquiry, and they really don't interact. I mean, it seems to me we do try to bring coherence and try to make sense of the world as a whole with all the things that we take to be important. So it does seem that we want to see what light science can shine on Scripture and what Scripture may be able to shine on science. If I think there are places where the insights go both ways. And I don't think it's an accident that people like Newton, Faraday, were deeply influenced by the Scriptures and even inspired in their science by the Scriptures. But it seems that once science has gotten rolling and gives us reliable information about star formation, speed of light, certain basics about the universe, that we get a universe that is much older than we might have suspected simply by a straightforward reading of Scripture. And when that happens, it seems that it is incumbent on us to say, hey, maybe we need to interpret anew certain things that where we thought the interpretation was just a given. You know, and I think it's that sort of openness that we need to cultivate. I think especially in a culture where Christianity has been so much in retreat, that becomes difficult. And so it's much easier to take a ghetto mentality and say, hey, let's just we'll just talk to each other, we'll take the old tried and true, and we'll ignore the challenges that are coming to us from, in this case, science. And I don't think it's a healthy approach.
Well, fair point, but here's what I'm trying to say. You know, you have people in the progressive creationist movement, and that's just an example. They have an astronomy text in their hand, and with that astronomy text in their hand, they're contending that the book of Job, probably the oldest book in the Bible, they're saying that that contains a stunning reference to Big Bang cosmology. He alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. Then on the other hand, you have skeptics supposing that an unevolved Job taught earth was set on pillars. You know, he shakes the earth from its place and makes its pillars tremble. And so what I'm suggesting here is that it is unenlightened to try to read modern cosmology into a biblical text. You end up making the Bible look foolish if you start looking at the context of the passage.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I mean, it seems to me, you know, it becomes, what is it, eisegeting, or, you know, you're trying to find a justification for whatever the latest science is, and that becomes problematic. And as you say, I mean, with Job, I mean, it's the language, I mean, it's so rich in imagery. That's not where you want to go. I think, you know, this idea of finding consonances between scripture and science, there are people who do that, but I think many more on the more liberal and moderate side have thrown up their hands and just think that basically the Bible has been entirely passé, that science has shown us that the Bible is not to be trusted. So I guess if it was a matter of reading into the Bible certain scientific insights that may not really be there, that may still bespeak more of a faith than the approach which says the Bible is scientifically hopeless, and you know, science has supplanted any insights we may get from the scriptures. So
that's absolutely right. Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I was reading, I just wrote a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. In the process of that book, I started reading a book on the myth of the Andalusian paradise. And I thought a lot of the things that you went through in your experience in academia resonated with what I was reading in that particular book, in that here you have someone going back to history and demonstrating beyond the peradventure of a doubt that this whole idea that in Andalusia you had Muslims and Christians and Jews living in perfect harmony, and when the Muslims are in control, things are always wonderful, et cetera, et cetera. Now you have someone that is saying that's simply not true. All of the evidence historically goes in a different direction. This is simply a cultural narrative that we're advancing today. And the moment you start questioning the cultural perspective that's popular, you run into all kinds of difficulties. But at any rate, in that book, there are a number of issues that are brought up. One of them, and I thought you could speak to all of them in one way or another, but one of them that really caught my attention was stakeholder interests and incentives that affect the research of academics in the sciences no less than in the humanities. You've experienced this to some degree. And I think you alluded to this earlier. There's stakeholder interests. So you get hauled into the president's office. Why? Well, because there are people who are donating money, and if you don't toe the line, these people are going to stop donating money. That affects how the president's going to look at your tenure in the university.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you raise an interesting point. It reminds me of perhaps what was a turning point for me when I stopped getting invitations to speak at Christian events. I'm not sure that it was so publicized, but I remember, I think at Iowa State, I was giving a talk, and I decided just to be very straightforward, and it's relevant to your stakeholder point here, because there was a seminary I taught at before, Southwestern, and anybody who wants, they could figure out what the place was, but I remember talking to a psychologist there who's on faculty, and I'm not sure how long he was going to be able to keep his job, because this nouthetic approach where basically all psychology should just be biblical studies was taking hold there, but that's beside the point. But anyway, he took some informal surveys with his class and found that among his students, about 50% had been looking at pornography, and not too long ago. And this was well over 10 years ago. I'm not sure what the numbers would be now. And he brought that to the attention of the powers that be, the seminary president, and it was immediately shot down. It was, no, we're not going to address that. We're not going to try to deal with that. And the problem is, it would have looked bad, right? I mean, you know, to donors and everything, if this was recognized as a problem. And my point at this talk that I gave at Iowa State was that, I just don't think as Christians we're particularly honest about what we're dealing with. I think we often try to cover things up, and I think the stakeholder thing is what's largely behind it. We've got our incentives. We've got to look good. We've got to and the possibility that we're what did the Apostle Paul say of all sinners of whom I am chief, right? You know, now was that just a rhetorical flourish, or is it really as Christians we still are sinners? We've really got some problems, and we need to admit that. And it's but I think it's in the cover up that we really hurt ourselves, and and I think that's what happens when they're stakeholders. You've got to keep up appearances, right? You got to keep those donors happy. You got to keep things moving along, and it ends up biting you in the rear end in the end, so because I think what it means is that you're going to be powerless. Because if you live a lie, you don't have moral authority. You don't have that strength. I'm not saying this to raise myself up. I mean, I'll go right with Paul. You know, I'm of sinners, I'm chief, right? You know, but I think it's kind of like the Socratic principle, right? You know, Socrates realized that he was ignorant, and the problem was the people that he was dealing with. They thought they knew something, and that's why he was this gadfly. And I think we probably need something similar as Christians, but we play a lot of pretend, and I think it's precisely for that stakeholder incentive that you described.
And then there's this motivated blindness. It's the motivated being the operative word, motivated blindness, the inability to perceive inconvenient data, because it somehow or other muddies the water of whatever the paradigm or tributary narrative that you're pushing.
Yeah, I mean, what was it? The much quoted line of Upton Sinclair, it's impossible to get somebody to understand something when their livelihood depends on not understanding it. I think that's a problem when the incentives really align against you in this way. So, but it's Jesus says, right? I'm the way, the truth, and the life, and truth is extremely important. But I think often there's this kind of a simplistic sense of truth. You know, is that door red? Yeah, it's red. You know, but I think there are deeper types of truths, and seeing the truth about ourselves, especially. There's one counseling psychologist that I knew who always would say, the presenting problem is never the real problem. You know, I mean, there's a lot of subtexts going on in all of our lives, and I think it's bringing those to light that ends up being important, and that's where the real healing therapy gets done. I don't think it's any accident that Jesus was a healer. You know, I think it's one of our fundamental needs, but I think often we don't recognize where we need healing. I mean, in a sense, the physical healing, you know, you got to broken bone, or you're sick, you've got a disease, that's pretty straightforward. But I think there's a lot of healing where we don't even recognize the sickness, and that's a problem. So I think that's why we do need real prophets. I mean, people who tell us the truth, who speak forth. You know, that's what prophet means, to speak forth and tell us what's really going on. And I'm not sure we've got enough of them these days.
Seems to me, too, that especially in the field that you were dealing with, there's a lot of shoddy research that's done by people who have credentials, shoddy research, and then that shoddy research by the professors or the people in the know is now repeated by journalists. So you have these false narratives that are circulating. They drive me crazy. I don't know how they affect you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I was often looking at a more theoretical level, so it wasn't that any particular result was going to be decisive. It was more the sweep of what was the revolution in molecular biology was showing about molecular machines or things like that. So, but I hear what you're saying. I mean, I think science is a human enterprise, and human enterprises can get corrupted, especially when the incentives, when there are systematic problems, and I think with science, especially given how much of it these days depends on NSF funding, DARPA funding, what have you. I mean, it's money driven, and you've got to get those research grants. You don't get those research grants, you don't even get tenure these days. So there are these incentives, and with so much of scientific research, it seems that there are also ways to fudge it. You know, so you there's something called a file drawer effect, for instance. I mean, let's say you want a statistically significant result. You do an experiment, didn't come out the way you wanted. Well, just put it in a file drawer and do it again until you get the result you want. So there's, I think, a lot of results that are out there in the literature. I mean, this has been, I think, a common finding, is that it's hard to replicate them. Because, you know, now why should they be hard to replicate? Well, maybe a lot of what we're dealing with are file drawer effects. And that's just one type of problem.
You have, like Philip Johnson, cast a large shadow over the ID movement. It seems to me that this movement is against the cultural agenda. People are selling a cultural agenda. If you try to swim upstream, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. If you go along with the cultural agenda, you're going to be rewarded. And probably the best example of this was Judge Jones, the Dover trial. His ruling against ID, I think it was back in 2005, he ends up being voted one of the 10 sexiest geeks by Wired. Time magazine votes him as one of the 100 most important thinkers. And if you read him, that's really bizarre. And then he's awarded honorary doctorates. I mean, the benefits of going along with the cultural narrative are pretty great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Machiavelli put it this way. He said, I mean, if you go along with the mainstream, you know, that's where the rewards are. But if you go against the flow, basically you lose all those people who are profiting from the mainstream. But then people who are undecided, they're still not sure to go along because there's no rewards. No, this is all pretty iffy, you know, whether you're going to succeed. So it's to start a new scientific approach, new cultural approach, it's risky at best. Now, I think if there had been, well, I don't know. I mean, I think, for instance, right around the time that the intelligent design movement was getting going, there was a guy, John Templeton, who I got to meet. I mean, actually, for a while, he and his organization were kind of looking at intelligent design and thinking, maybe this is a place we want to support. But this was about 1998, 97. But then they pulled out. In fact, I'm told there was a meeting at which they decided, how can we destroy intelligent design? And but they've put their money with theistic evolution, and that's been much more that's what's been mainstreamed in so much of the CCCU world, the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. So we didn't even have that benefit, right? I mean, it wasn't there was nobody with really, really deep pockets that was saying, hey, really like intelligent design, let's give it a go. So we've been operating on a shoestring, and it's I don't know. I mean, how it's all going to turn out. I thought that when I got into this debate was in its early times, like 1996, the Mere Creation Conference that we did at Biola, I did a volume conference proceedings on that. I thought that by the time I hit retirement that we'd see these ideas mainstreamed and really we'd see at least the beginnings of a paradigm shift in the culture. And I'm not convinced that that's going to happen. Now my perspective is much more that of Hebrews 11, you know, seeing the promises from afar, but wondering just when that's going to happen.
Well, it's kind of strange, too, when you think about the fact that, and maybe this is too strong, correct me if you think it is, but ideas being blackballed in places like Wheaton and Calvin and Westmont, et cetera. And I have 12 kids, and I've had a lot of kids in a lot of these universities, including Wheaton.
Yeah.
But ID seems to be blackballed there.
Well, that's, it's funny. I mean, you mentioned the key institutions in what I'm calling the CCCU, but we're talking about 100 schools or more. And I would say that among the mainstream Christian colleges and universities, intelligent design doesn't have a place. It's theistic evolution. And what is theistic evolution? I mean, it's basically saying Darwin got it right, or the mainstream scientific approach is correct. We're evolved through what appears scientifically to be a blind, purposeless evolutionary process. And then you add on top, and God did it that way. Okay, well, you know, and that's, so that's, and I think that's the approach. So, and it's Wheaton, Westmont, all the schools you ticked off. That seems to me exactly right. I mean, I couldn't get a job at these places. I couldn't get a job at the fundamentalist places, and the mainstream academy is also out. So, you know, so I've been a businessman these last 5-6 years.
Now, there's a time that you had sort of an optimism, right? I mean, you were involved in developing ID as a scientific research program at Baylor University. I mean, that had to be a time of great optimism. It was squashed pretty early on, but, you know, at least you had a passion and you thought this could really work, but it was hard to kick against the goads.
Well, you know, and it's, I mean, even after, I mean, I was on faculty at Baylor till 2005. I mean, the center that Intelligent Design Center called the Michael Polanyi Center, which I did 1999, 2000, even when that was squashed, and it was, I was still optimistic. I mean, and I was still trying to promote it there at Baylor, and I saw possibilities. And even after the 2005 Dover trial with Judge Jones, whom you adverted to, I was still optimistic. I think where things turned for me was when I saw the fundamentalists, as it were, turn on intelligent design and turn on me. You know, and at that point, that just became difficult. And but you know, I should say, I mean, I retract nothing of what I've done on intelligent design. I think the work holds up. I think some of the earlier work needed to be upgraded, updated, and it was, you know. And my sense is that I hit the nail on the head from the beginning, and I think our arguments in the intelligent design community have been better. You know, I think we've got the stronger case. But there's an old New Yorker cartoon which shows an attorney in front of his client, and he says, "Well, Mr. Pitnick, you've got a very strong case. Now, how much justice can you afford?" You know, and I think that's the thing. I mean, I think we've got the better case. But there's a marketing dimension to science and culture, and you know, who's got the megaphone? Who's got the Madison Avenue bucks? Who's controlling the academy at all levels? And it's not me. It's not my closest colleagues. You know, so I think we're still a Gideon's band. Now, Gideon did win. You know, but I don't know at what point we're going to see victory.
Well, you got to be faithful. I mean, at the end of the day, that's not whether you win or lose. It's about being
faithful.
Well,
that's it. Yeah. That's it. You know, and so I'm. You're exactly right. I mean, it's. And I think the. It's interesting that God's chosen people, it's a small nation, right? And it's a nation that generally was, you know, except for the reign of Solomon, really wasn't in any way dominant. And yet, so I think that gives us also an indication that it's often, truth is not decided by majorities or how large a contingent you've got in your favor.
Let me ask you, what worries you about the future of evangelicalism?
Good question. I think being honest about who we are, the struggles that we have, I think that's what I described at this one talk that I gave. But I think there's also a sense of just being informed, educated, thoughtful people. I think, are we well read? Have we thought things through? Do we know what the big questions, big problems are? Or are we just kind of going along for the ride? So I think that's a concern for me. I don't think it's so much, you know, are we going to win the culture? I think if we get some I don't want to say fundamentals, but let's call it basics right, I think we'll be okay. I think having a perspective, I mean, I know it used to be a worldview perspective, and that was so big, but I think understanding the signs of the times, I think I'm not sure we do. I think we're often caught up in the fashions, the things of the day. What was it in Paul in Athens? The Athenians are always looking for something new, and I think that's a temptation. So I don't know. I mean, that question just kind of caught me off, so this is shooting from the hip. I'm not
sure. Yeah, it's fine. But, I mean, look, you're an academic. Not many people have a PhD in mathematics and then another one in philosophy and then a Master of Divinity from Princeton. These are pretty impressive credentials. But what I want to segue to from those credentials is talking about kids. I have 9 natural, 3 adopt, 12 kids. I think you've got 3 kids.
3.
And, you know, talking about sending kids off to college, now I've had a lot of kids go through university already, but this is a very difficult situation. And maybe you can talk to some of the people listening in about what they do when they make choices, educational choices. I mean, obviously there's a lot of money involved, unless you have scholarships, but how do you not feel like you have just been raped? You know, you spend $40,000 sending a kid to a school and they come back and they don't recognize you or you don't recognize them. How do you choose some, I don't know if you call it a safe place, but a place where people can really think? Because it seems to me, even with this, I just use the more generic term, this weapons control debate that's going on right now, seems like you have kids that are simply used as stage props. I mean, they're pushing a cultural agenda. They don't even know what the agenda is. They say a bunch of dumb things. They have someone behind them. They're sort of like puppets in the game. How do you get these kids to actually think for themselves? And how do you make sure that they're in an environment where they're allowed to really develop the cognitive thinking process and where they can mature in a safe way as well?
Yeah. Well, I think there are probably 2 broad approaches. I mean, one is to find schools that are theologically sound. You know, I mean, so it's where there is a certain degree of safety, and that's, I think they exist. I think they're in the minority. I think just because a school has a Christian label on it doesn't mean that it's a safe place. And I would encourage parents that if they're going to be visiting a school, you know, look in the student center. What's on the bulletin boards? You know, I mean, our LGBTQ, is there an agenda there, even if it's, supposedly a Christian place? So, I mean, you want the place that's wholesome and that's where the administration isn't speaking out of 2 sides of the mouth, and I know places where that happens. I mean, they're very good at allaying parents' concerns, but then, you know, deep down, they're being driven by a liberal secular agenda. So that can happen. So I think I think one approach is to look for a place that's safe, and I think there are, some of them are out there. But I think probably a better approach is what I might call inoculation, where you're aware that the your children are going to be going into places where there are dangers, but prepare them. You know, so that means ideally if they've had a Christian high school and even grade school experience where they've been taught some things about the faith, worldview, understanding the sorts of challenges they're going to be facing. That's what I mean by inoculation. You got to be exposed to the sorts of challenges. And I would say even with that, you want a place where there's still going to be outlets for your students, so your children. So, I mean, outlets in the sense of Christian groups on campus, parachurch, where you've got some strong churches in the area, where you've got ideally also a faculty presence where the faculty are vocal about their faith. You know, there are schools I know, secular schools, where I think none of that really exists. You know, and so I think if that's the case, then I would be very wary about sending a child there. But if there are good support structures in place, I think with churches, faculty, that you ideally where you know some faculty and you where you've got your child can be under the tutelage of somebody that you trust there who's on faculty, that would be even better. But short of having a place that's safe, you know, and I mean it's. No place is going to be totally safe, but I think there are some that are going to be safer than others. I would say to do the inoculation approach, you know, where you make sure they're prepared mentally. One book that that looks really good to me is Jay Budziszewski's How to Stay a Christian in College, but there are others out there, and then find a school where those support structures are there. So that would be my advice.
Yeah, I think it's good advice. Hey, I have no doubt whatsoever you get back into ID one way or the other, but I mean, that's just my opinion. But you're in the business of education. You're developing educational content, products, software. This, I think, is very, very important. And I'd like to get a little more perspective on what you're doing in this area.
Okay. Let me just say this. I mean, that whole work I've tended to do very much sub rosa in the sense that I've kept my identity in the background, partly or mainly because I didn't want my notoriety with intelligent design subverting that. So I'm going to play this pretty close to the vest. But I mean, I've been involved in educational websites where we help students find their way to schools. And then the more interesting project for me, though, is developing educational technologies to help people. And that's we've invested quite a bit in that. I think we're still in the, if you take a chess analogy, opening, middle, and end game, I think we're still in the opening phases of that. But I think we've been looking at some VR 360 technologies, so virtual reality, seeing what we can do there. I think there's a lot of interest in that. And so just getting the technology and working with that, being able to work with it effectively. We've got, for instance, an OZO device, which has 12 cameras. And the thing is that you've got these very high-resolution cameras that are all in this one spherical type super camera, as it were. But then you've got these 12 different images that are coming in real time, and they've got to be stitched together in some way. And so just even developing the software to deal with that, that's not out of the box. I mean, so that's one of the things we've had to do. So just getting into a place where we can do these sorts of VR technologies and applying them successfully, that's taken quite a bit of work. And then developing courses, what would it be like if we have kind of traditional courses, you know, video, but then we can offer some sort of 360 virtual reality, embed different things in there to help the students. And so it's these are the sorts of things we've been looking at, and we'll see where it goes.
It's interesting when you say that you have to hold it close to the vest, because your own identity could be deflective to the overall success.
Yeah.
And I find that just I mean, it's just horrifying. I mean, given,
well, you know, it's funny because here I am listening to, you know, I'm talking to him, thinking, you know, Hank has a pretty good reach, you know, his audience, and yet I'm not going to say what the company is, because I've got another, there's a person there who's an ID guy, but he actually has a position at a mainstream university, and for me to identify myself and allow people to draw that connection would be a problem, you know. And it's, I mean, it's something I've experienced consistently over the years being involved with intelligent design, where I'll get an email from somebody who offers me some helpful insight and then says, and please don't mention that I gave this to you because I'm up for tenure and I can't afford to be identified with you.
I mean, I just think that's horrendous. I mean, you think about what you have contributed. I mean, it's monumental, quite frankly, and the way you have been pilloried by people like Ken Ham, it's just obscene. I'm sorry, it's just obscene. I've experienced some of the same
thing
things.
Ken Ham doesn't control my Wikipedia entry. I mean, it's Darwinian materialists, and, you know, in the very first sentence, it's intelligent design, pseudoscience, discredited, all of that's in there, you know, and I can't get it changed. There's no way, you know. So,
well, I mean, you're getting it from both the secular world and the spiritual domain.
Yeah. Well, but just, you know, I do want to put things in perspective. I mean, you know, and I've stressed this, you know, this is nothing like, you know, what people have experienced under Stalinism and what have you. I mean, I've always had food on the table. I've never been relegated to a gulag or anything like that. I mean, so it's, you know, it's been unpleasant, but it hasn't been horrific. And so, you know, so we deal with it, you know, as we can. But it's... It is what it is, and you know, and I think what Christ calls us to is to be faithful, and so we just keep plugging away.
Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness; theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you on account of me. Rejoice, be glad; great is your reward in heaven. I love your perspective. You know, talk about your son. You have a son that has severe autism. I wouldn't bring it up if you hadn't brought it up publicly in a lot of venues.
Yeah.
But how has that shaped your perspective on life?
Yeah. I will speak to that. I do want to say, you know, with the verse you quoted from Matthew about persecution, you know, I always am hesitant to say that I was persecuted, because it seems persecution, we're talking martyrs, people have had their tongues pulled out, tortured, you know. I mean, so there's that whole history there of Christians who have really, really suffered. So I don't even want to go that far, okay? Insulted, okay.
Hey, Bill, that's you qualify.
Okay, well...
You don't qualify in the sense you just described, but you qualify.
Okay, well, I'll leave that to you, you know, but for me, I've never quite seen it in that way. Now, with regard to my autistic son, yeah, this has been... probably the most painful thing in my life, and I sometimes wonder if it's made me a better person or a worse person. I mean, but it's, you know, it's not really about me. I mean, it's about him and what we can do to try to help him get well, but or better. But yeah, I mean, he was developmentally on track. He's a twin, and I've got videos of him when he was still 18 months, 20 months. And I thought he was going to be the brightest of the bunch. I mean, and the other two children are very bright. And things just collapsed for him. And I know this is controversial, but it was, you know, it's anecdotal evidence, but anecdotes can be quite compelling when you're on the receiving end of the anecdote. But there was a round of vaccines that he got, and he was never the same. And he there's a whole syndrome that often goes with autism. So there were infections. These infections would not go away with even the very strongest antibiotics. And his life cognitively collapsed. He's nonverbal. My wife or I have to shower him, clean him, wipe him, dress him, all of that. And he's 17 now, and it's, he is mainly or largely potty trained, so that's good. And he can feed himself, and he's, there's a lot of love and a lot of joy that we've had, but it's also just been extremely constricting in terms of what we can do. And so I think part of one reason also that I just don't get out much and speak much on intelligent design is that it's just very hard to do with him there. One of us always has to be with him. When he's at school, and he is at school, I think it's two-on-one that he has. There's a movie or film that came out some time ago called Vaxxed by Andrew Wakefield, somebody who I know and who I respect despite his Wikipedia entry. If anybody is listening there and thinks that he's been discredited, I would say he's been smeared. But, I would say my son is more severe than anybody that you see in that film. When his caseworker came by, she has 50 people, and she says, there's only one who's as extreme. And most of these kids there, like him, have been put in homes. And I think at some point he may end up in a home, but for now he's still with us, and we want a good living situation for him. But yeah, I think it's put things in perspective in the sense that just a lot of things just don't seem quite as important. The sort of theological bickering that I was familiar with, I think I've lost a lot of patience for that just because of the enormity of what my son has gone through and experiences. And I think what's troubling for me, it's one thing if you were a materialist, you might say, well, it's just, he's just cognitively impaired. He's got the mental life of a whatever, But, I believe he's made in the image of God, and I see glimmers that he's in there still, But it's like he's trapped. And I remember about 10 years ago taking him to, we were living in the Waco area, and he went to, the school arranged for him to go see a sensory integration person, occupational therapy sensory integration person, and she was having him do various tasks and he was able to do very little. And she was saying, "Oh, touch your nose, touch this, touch that," and he wasn't responding. Then she said, "Touch your eyes, touch your eyes," and she just kept persisting. And he became visibly upset, and then finally he blinked his eyes. Okay, so he understood, and he's got a lot of receptive language. But, what's so simple for us, just take your finger and put it on your eye, okay? Well, there's an apraxia there. He's unable to do it, and it's like he understood, and yet, can break your heart.
Yeah, it can break your heart. Oh, bless you. Bless you. Oh, Lord Jesus. Yeah, it's tough. It's tough. Life's tough. Bill, I just got back from seeing Elliot Miller, and, you know him well, editor-in-chief of the Christian Research Journal. He's been at the Christian Research Institute longer than I have, and for me to see him this weekend, I went out and bought some groceries, and I was in the store, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I thought this may be the last opportunity I have to do something for him, buying him groceries, and seeing the rapid deterioration, and life's tough. It's tough.
Yeah,
it's tough.
So I don't know. Sorry to lose it there.
Oh no, no problem.
Maybe you want to edit this out.
No, I don't want to edit anything out. I don't want to edit anything out. Part of the human condition.
Yeah, it is.
It's part of the human condition. And it's also an indication that you have a deep, deep love for your son. I mean, I know for all your kids and for your wife, but you have a deep love for your son. And I've talked to you about this over the years. I mean, you've been desperately looking for a solution because you love your son so much.
Well, yeah, I want to be careful about desperate. I mean, because the sense, you know, that you're hoping against hope. And I think, if anything, I think sometimes I've become more jaded about what are the options out there. But I still try to keep my eyes and ears open. And I think there are some therapies that are looking promising, some things that we've tried recently. And I think seen some progress, but it's often just very, very slow. And there's a sense in which, he's just lost a lot. You know, I mean, there are things he was doing at 1.5 that he's unable to do this to this day. You know, he would take the vacuum cleaner, plug it in, and vacuum. You know, when he was 1.5. You know, but that's all gone. You know, and so it's, and I think then there is also just the whole controversy of what may be causing this. So that's something I haven't really weighed into that. I don't know if and when I will, you know, because it's, I think, the etiology or causation that there, it's really figuring out what's going on. That's a tough problem. I think there are a lot of special interests that also want the answer to come out one way or the other. So it's, I don't know if at some point that's where I may end up putting a lot of my energies. But for now, I still want to see him get as well as he can.
Well, bless you. You know, Bill, I lost my dad. You lost your dad recently. How's that impacted you?
I think with my dad, I wrote a commemoration or memory of him, and that really helped me. I mean, I was pretty weepy through that, but he was 94. He had a good life, and I think it was time, you know. But that was in October. My mom was just diagnosed with cancer in February, and so basically gave her 6 months to live, 12 months if she gets on chemo, and she's not interested in chemo. So, trying some natural approaches, and I hope that helps. But I have to say, it's tough, and I really had hoped that my mom would have some good years still, and maybe she will, But I am a Christian, and I do believe, you know, my parents were born again, and I believe in being reunited with them. I mean, it's not a vain hope. So I can't say that it's just crushed me. You know, I miss my dad, but he had a good life, and I can rejoice in that, It's going to be okay. I think that's, as Christians, I think we can always say that. It's going to be okay. It'll be good. It's all going to work out. And that's a hope we have that I don't think really anybody else has.
That's right. You know, I want to bring up one other thing, and it's a statement that I read that you made where you said, I found self-deception as much among Christians as among atheists and agnostics. In fact, I've come to like dealing with seculars better than with Christians who use religion as a cloak to cover their pride and absence of love. And I find a lot of truth in that, but maybe you can elaborate.
Well, I think that was written at one of my perhaps more cynical moments about some of the things I dealt with in the Christian world. You know, I don't know if I want to say, you know, we all sin in our own ways. You know, I think secularists have their own types of sins, Christians have theirs, and it's. But I think there it does become a problem with Christians, because there's always the charge of hypocrisy, right? I mean, we know we're supposed to be living better. You know, we know that there's this standard that we're called to. And it becomes particularly problematic when we pretend that we're holding to that standard and we don't, you know, and then when that is, when that covering is removed, and you know, we see it with politicians who claim they're Christians, you know, and it's it has a very distasteful feel. You know, I'm not sure. I want to be careful about moralizing. You know, I've got my own sins, right? You know, so it's I think that was I'm not sure where you're quoting that from. I think that was an interview, and at the time, I think I was responding just to some of the pain that I had dealing with my certain experiences I had with Christians in the academy. So,
yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. But look, Bill, I have such immense regard for you and for what you have done. As I said, you've cast a long shadow, and I do hope and pray that you continue to weigh in on the intelligent design sphere. I mean, it's critical, and you have an ability that is very, very unique in this area, and so I just want to encourage you to do all you can. I mean, we only have one life. It's soon going to be passed, and only what's done for Christ will last. Sounds trite, but it's absolutely true, and you have so much to contribute.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's good of you to say it. Let me, you know, I've thought of, I know I've written that I'm retired from intelligent design, but there's people come out of retirement, and there is, I think, my original book in the Design Inference, I think it needs a facelift. So I've been thinking about that. So let me take that under advisement. You know, maybe I should just say I've been on vacation from intelligent design. You know? And,
you know, well, you needed like, one. You've been hammered. You know? You needed one.
Yeah. Well, let's keep me in prayer about this, and we'll see where it goes. I mean, I'm open to it. You know, and we need to be doing what God would have us to do. You know, I mean, it's not about us. So I get that. Yeah.
Well, you are much loved and very much respected at the Christian Research Institute. And as I said, you've cast a very large shadow, and we've all benefited from it. You are definitely a hero of the faith in my book, and I loved having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Hank, and I just appreciate so much what you've done over the years, and you know, your biblical faithfulness, and really trying to give people a true and balanced view of what the scriptures are saying and what they can do for people's lives. So thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, you got it. And thanks for joining me. I mean, for everybody listening in, I thought there were some really, really fantastic moments during this podcast. And there's so many people that like to hear this conversation. You can make that happen. Go to iTunes, give this this podcast a 5-star rating. And, you know, if you get a chance, pray for Bill. His contributions have been enormous, but I think the best is yet to come. So thanks, everybody, for tuning into this edition of Hank Unplugged. Look forward to seeing you on the next episode. So long for now.